Britain agrees to accept more migrants, but all of Europe is feeling the strain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, September 7th. Thanks for joining us on this Labor Day. We'll start with an update on Europe's migrant crisis. Austria and Germany have taken in thousands of people over the weekend, many of whom were turned away from Hungary and even detained there for days. The EU continues to struggle with how to deal with a surge of asylum seekers. Bethany Bell is the BBC's Vienna correspondent and joins us now from Vienna. She's been reporting from the Hungary border and elsewhere. Bethany, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing today. What have you seen today and over the weekend?
Well, over the weekend, I was at the border when the first busloads of people who were allowed over from Hungary to Austria arrived on foot. They had been dropped on the Hungarian side. And then there was this flow of people that really peaked on Saturday and steadied out Sunday. But today, one of the EU's commissioners has been in Austria at the main asylum processing centre here, which is extremely overcrowded. Austria has seen a very big increase in the number of people applying for asylum this year. And he called on the EU to take what he called comprehensive action to solve this crisis.
And today we saw British Prime Minister David Cameron saying that Britain will take 20,000 refugees. Last week, we had reported that Britain was tightening border controls. Is that pressure starting to have an impact and countries are opening up a bit?
Clearly, we've had this announcement from David Cameron today. We've had France saying it will take up to 24,000 refugees and that there is a plan underway to try and make countries share the burden of all these people who are arriving here. But there is also a lot of resistance. Countries very close to Austria, countries like Slovakia, like the Czech Republic, Hungary, of course, very suspicious of the idea of taking in a great influx of refugees. There is also the question of money. Countries like Germany, of course, are much better off than small countries like Slovakia. So a big row going on in the EU at the moment as to how to deal with this crisis, which most of the leaders are saying, you know, is not something that's short term. It's something that Europe is going to have to deal with over the long term.
Germany is emerging as a very sympathetic character here. Is it surprising that that country has been so welcoming? I think they got a different reputation for taking a much harder line during, say, the Greek debt negotiations.
This is a different issue. This is about helping refugees. And as many of Europe's leaders, including the German leader, are saying, it is an obligation of European countries to give help to people fleeing war and conflict. That is something that is deeply embedded in European law and treaties. But also there's an economic argument. Some people say, look, Germany needs more people. It needs immigrants. And in order to keep, because, you know, it has an aging population, it needs young people who can contribute to its society and to its economy. So all of those reasons, perhaps why Germany emerging as this leader in taking in so many people.
That's Bethany Bell from the BBC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Markets are closed in the U.S., but Europe and Asia are watching China. We'll have more when we do the numbers. On a nice long 3-day weekend like this one, you might be relaxing with a good book. Chances are that book was actually on paper. Publishers report that the sales of e-books are down and sales of paperbacks are up. It used to be the opposite, but recently some big publishers are raising the price of their e-books, sometimes even higher than the hardbacks. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the details.
E-book sales decreased 7.5% in the first 3 months of the year, and they've kept going down over the summer. In the meantime, paperback sales went up 8.5% in the first quarter.
It's an example of being careful about what you wish for.
Jonathan Kirsch teaches at New York University's Professional Publishing Program. What major publishers had wished for was to set their own prices on ebooks. They thought Amazon's discounts were too steep. Since establishing new deals with the online retailer, the big publishers have raised prices. And what they've discovered, says Kirsch, is that it's not easy to reset consumer expectations.
iTunes established the 99-cent song. Amazon multiplied it by 10. A consumer has been educated to expect that an ebook is going to be under $10.
Instead, the average ebook price right now among the five biggest publishers is $10.81. But there's some debate in the publishing world as to whether higher prices are the cause of slumping sales. Ted Hill heads THA Consulting and is a 30-year publishing veteran.
Publishing is a cyclical business, and the way books sell before Christmas is very different from how they sell in the summer.
Hill says publishers are unlikely to change direction just yet because they're trying to apply a well-worn pricing model.
Movies don't release films on Netflix first. They try and get $15 or $20 out of them out of the box office first.
Similarly, Hill says publishers want consumers buying new books at full price before discounts kick in later. I'm Nova Safa for Marketplace.
Labor Day marks the official end of summer and the unofficial kickoff of the holiday shopping season. And it might not be too early to jump on that shopping, because this year there's a wrinkle on the labor side. Retailers are having a hard time finding workers for their warehouses as unemployment drops and younger workers look for more desirable jobs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Retailers like this Nordstrom Rack in downtown Washington are trying to get rid of their summer stuff. That's because they have to make room for all of the new stuff they've ordered for the holiday shopping season, which is now sitting in understaffed warehouses. It's hard for retailers to find forklift drivers and people to unload truckfuls of products.
If people are struggling right now to bring the stuff into the warehouse, then they're definitely going to have a problem when it comes to getting it out.
That's Frank Leo. He's a partner and retail strategist at Kurt Salmon. He says he's heard from a couple dozen major retailers who are scrambling to find warehouse workers. They'll need to double or even quadruple their warehouse staff over the next few months to send stuff to stores, but also to ship online orders. Leo says retailers tell him they're competing for workers who have lots of other job options, like Uber.
The younger workforce is more interested in working on their terms, doing something that they find to be more interesting than packing boxes in a warehouse.
Harry Katz is a professor of collective bargaining at Cornell University. He says employers got spoiled when the unemployment rate was high. He says now the market's changed.
The tightening that's occurred in the labor market requires employers to pay maybe $1 or $2 more and per hour to get the workers they need. But we're not talking about increases that require a doubling of pay.
Some retailers say they're already paying more and thinking about offering extra benefits like on-site childcare and mobile health clinics. The warehouse worker shortage could add up to big headaches for consumers who shop online, at least those like me who wait until the last minute. You just can't do that this year because it'll probably take shorthanded retailers longer to ship out your order. Yuri Wormser is an analyst at eMarketer. He says retailers need a cushion.
You might need more time. Instead of having 2-day shipping, you might need 4-day shipping or, you know, some 5-day shipping.
The good news? Wormser says more retailers will offer free shipping. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
For many years now, developers have realized that old abandoned mine sites can have a whole new life as golf courses. Old gypsum mines in Michigan, for example, and an old copper mine in Montana that was actually a Superfund site. The latest example comes from remote central Florida, where land turned inside out by phosphate mining is now an upscale resort that's getting a lot of attention in the golfing world. Robin Sussingham has more.
The Stream Song Golf Resort is kind of in the middle of nowhere. You know you're getting close when you have to stop for the trains carrying phosphate rock. The development of Stream Song by the Mosaic Company has boosted Polk County's economy by creating hundreds of jobs. It's also helped bring in record-high tourist tax dollars from golfers like Doug Smith, who flew down from Tifton, Georgia.
It is different than anything in Florida, and it creates an opportunity for a good friend of mine and I to come down, spend a couple of days, and just kind of disappear.
There are a lot of golf courses in Florida, but Stream Song employees say the fast and firm conditions here set it apart. They say sand creates these dry, fast conditions, and there's more of it here than other U.S. courses. Stream Song has more in common with the coastal links of Scotland and Ireland. Sand is gold in the golf business. It's also a byproduct of phosphate mining. Fertilizer giant Mosaic CFO, who also happened to be a high-level amateur golfer, came up with golf as a creative solution for a mined-out piece of the corporation's vast land holdings. Mosaic execs are betting that golfers will make the trip for a course that intrigues them. Scott Wilson is Stream Song's golf director.
You don't see links-style golf with deep water lakes and sand formations like this anywhere in the world.
Those lakes are 40-foot-deep phosphate pits, and the first tee, where Wilson is preparing to tee off, is 100 feet high atop one of the towering sandy dunes created during the mining process.
We have the tee markers here, the old railroad ties, which is a nod to the mining industry with the train cars and the train tracks.
The Mosaic Company is not trying to disguise the fact that this resort is built on an old phosphate mine. One of the four restaurants is called P205, after the phosphate molecule. On display in the lobby is a fossilized jawbone of a giant megalodon shark that was excavated here. And the land, disfigured by drag lines decades ago, has matured into something strange but lovely. Native grasses cover the towers of sand, and largemouth bass swim in the lakes.
It was left like this, and it's beautiful. You see exposed sand everywhere you look, and then all of a sudden there's a lake, and then there's some grassy dunes and some sandy dunes.
You happy about that one?
Oh, yeah.
Stream Song's been getting a lot of praise from the golf media, with courses that were designed by Tom Doak and the team of Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw. Mosaic executives, however, say they won't be leaving Fertilizer for the resort business anytime soon. They say they don't have any other holdings like Stream Song, and no one else does either. In Tampa, I'm Robin Sussingham for Marketplace.
Coming up?
Well, my journey started with a sandwich. I'm a mom and I pack a lot of lunches.
And that's where the U.S. military comes in. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets were closed in the U.S., but commodities news and the reopening of the Chinese exchanges after a holiday gave traders in Europe and Asia plenty to chew on. Shares in mining and commodities trading company Glencore jumped more than 7% after it announced plans to cut debt and trim its African copper operations. In Japan, Toshiba posted a more than $300 million loss for the year, but rose nearly 2% after it announced a large-scale restructuring. British supermarket firm Tesco announced the sale of its South Korean business for more than $6 billion, but its shares ended only slightly higher on the day. European markets were mostly higher. In London, the FTSE 100 popped up 0.5%, the DAX 0.7%, and in Paris, the CAC 40 hiked nearly 0.6%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Later this month, Pope Francis will be visiting Washington. He'll become the first pope to address a joint session of Congress, and that should be pretty interesting. Pope Francis's focus on income inequality and his comments about redistribution of wealth have caused some consternation among American conservatives. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons digs into the pope's economic philosophy.
In the Pope's first days, he promised a renewed focus on the poor and shed the luxury of his office. He helped to engineer a thaw in relations between Washington and Havana, and he even denounced trickle-down economics.
Here in the United States, for example, it's quite common to believe that the, you know, that the common good is automatically the result of the unhindered workings of the free market.
That's Stephen Schneck, director of the Institute for Policy Research and Catholic Studies at the Catholic University of America.
And for this pope and for Catholic teaching in general, that's not quite right.
Schneck says the Pope's philosophy is that the common good sets the principles and the market should be organized to support those principles. Federico Finkelstein, chair of the history department at the New School, says Francis is a conservative in the global sense. It's just that his economic outlook doesn't fit in the political binary that divides Republicans and Democrats.
It is mistaken to take the Pope's position on inequality through the lenses of what is right and what is left.
Pope Francis's focus on the poor and the distribution of wealth is a product of what he experienced as a priest ministering in the slums of Buenos Aires.
Historically, Latin America has been the most unequally distributed economic system in the world.
That's Father Matthew Carnes, a Jesuit priest and professor of government at Georgetown University.
He grew up on a regular basis seeing people left, as he would say, on the margins.
But as you may have noticed, the concept of income inequality is assuming a more prominent role in American political discourse. Pope Francis may have the opportunity to push the debate forward. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Physicians, as you may know, have to be board certified in order to practice. That used to be a one-time exam, but now it's become an exhausting process that includes recertification tests, a stream of online learning modules, fees, study materials, and prep courses, all of which have made board certification into a multi-million dollar industry. Gretchen Kuda-Crowen reports that doctors have had enough.
Paul Tierstein is the chief of cardiology at Scripps Clinic in San Diego, California. A little over a year ago, he sat down at his computer and attempted to complete the online modules required to maintain a certification with the American Board of Internal Medicine, or ABIM. He figured it'd be no big deal.
And I was shocked at how complicated it was and how much time it took and how unrelated to important patient care it was.
These modules, which became a requirement in 2014, must be completed every 2 years as part of something the boards call MOC, or Maintenance of Certification. The whole process costs Tierstein thousands of dollars for something he calls busy work.
We have to click on little answers, and we have to spend a lot of time logging in, logging out, and figuring out what module they want us to do. It's also very expensive, and it doesn't seem to help us.
Tierstein found the process so aggravating that he vented his frustrations to his colleagues on an online message board, asking if any of them had had similar experiences. He expected a few sympathetic responses, but instead, he found himself flooded with emails from doctors who shared his frustrations.
My colleagues were very upset about it, and after about a week of emailing back and forth, they began to ask me what I was going to do about it.
Around the same time, a handful of doctors began speaking out. They wrote papers in medical journals and editorials in the New York Times. And Tierstein gathered more than 20,000 signatures on a petition asking the ABIM, the largest of the 24 medical specialty boards, to remove the online modules. But when nothing happened, they decided they'd had enough.
This is what ultimately led to the formation of, as you know, the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons.
That's Paul Matthew. He's a neurologist and the director of continuing medical education at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. In January, he and 15 other physicians from institutions such as Harvard, the Mayo Clinic, Columbia, and Dartmouth joined Tierstein in forming the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons, or NBPAS, an alternative to the American Board of Medical Specialties, an organization he says has gone off course.
Now, the tail is wagging the dog. And really, these boards that were created for these very virtuous reasons are now shaking the system and saying, you're going to do what we tell you to do. And if you don't, you will not be able to practice. So pay these fees, do these modules, and just do what you're told.
Not long after the NBPAS announced its formation, the ABIM issued a public apology to its members and has since temporarily suspended a number of the MOC requirements.
We made a mistake with part of our program.
Robert Barron is the CEO of the ABIM.
We're committed now to listening to the community and learning other ways to do the work that we're doing. But we're committed to the idea that doctors need to keep up, that patients want us to keep up, that doctors want to keep up, and that that's really hard work.
But Tierstein says this isn't about avoiding hard work. It's about making sure the work they do helps them take better care of their patients. I'm Gretchen Kuda-Crowen for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
right, I can't help it. I have to do a Labor Day barbecue thing here. Because as you're prepping your Labor Day barbecue, stop for a second and ask yourself where those hamburger patties came from and who's responsible for making those hot dog buns. Anastasio Marx de Salcedo wrote a new book called The Combat Ready Kitchen. And it turns out the U.S. military has a huge influence on the food on your plate. Her investigation starts with a beef patty, but it was 8 months old and designed for U.S. troops in Kuwait. Anastasia, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Molly.
So tell me a little about how this book came about. How did you go from being a foodie and a food blogger to an interest in a several-year-old beef patty?
Well, my journey started with a sandwich. I'm a mom, and I pack a lot of lunches. Mm-hmm. And one day, I got to thinking about that sandwich, and I started to realize that the ingredients actually were probably no healthier nor fresher than the packaged ones that pleased my kids. And so I started doing research, and I discovered this obscure U.S. Army base, the Natick Soldier System Center. And I said, wow, what's the Army doing in our food?
And the answer seems to be quite a lot. Tell us about your visit inside this Natick Soldier Systems Center and what happens there.
The center actually houses a bunch of different research programs that have to do with supplying everything the individual soldier might need. And there, they develop improved rations. So that means actually coming up with the recipes for them and doing all sorts of tweaks to figure out how to get them to taste right and to have the right shelf life.
That's how the soldier meals are created. Then what is the progression from this facility to our lunchboxes and our grocery stores?
Well, that's really interesting. And the reason for that dates back to World War II. And part of that was this establishment of the system of federal laboratories. And what happens there, all the research and technology development is then passed to the consumer sector in hopes that it will be able to quickly convert to wartime production. And in the case of the Combat Feeding Directorate, that means that it can look to the food industry to convert its manufacturing lines to producing rations, or better yet, that some of those consumer items might already meet military specifications, which in fact many do.
And you have a number of interesting examples. Can you tell us, can you give us one of those examples of something that really started out as purely military and is very popular now?
Well, one of the examples that people really enjoy is cheese powder. And that came about in, from World War II, when the government was looking for ways to reduce the weight and volume of food, of the enormous amount of food that it was shipping overseas to feed troops. After mm-hmm. the end of the war, a whole little industry had sprung up to support this dehydrated cheese, and they needed a market. And that market ended up being the grocery manufacturers such as Kraft and Frito-Lay and Nabisco. And one of the very first products to use this cheese powder was the Cheeto.
And what else are they working on at Natick that we might want to know about or keep an eye out for?
Well, on the product side, there's one that I know that everybody is going to be excited to see, which is the shelf-stable pizza. And this will be a pizza that will be wrapped in regular packaging that you can store in a closet or in your glove compartment or on your shelf and just unwrap and eat as is.
Anastasio Marx de Salcedo is the author of Combat Ready Kitchen, and it is fascinating. Thank you so much, Anastasia.
Thank you so much for having me, Molly.
This final note before we go, a last bit of news on the theme of labor. President Obama today signed an executive order that requires federal contractors to give paid sick leave to their workers, up to 7 days a year or more if they want to grant it. The president has been aggressive about changing workplace policies, starting with the government, where he has the most control. The new sick leave rules will only affect about 300,000 employees, and as it turns out, they won't go into effect until 2017, after the president leaves office. And that's it. That's our show. Thanks for joining us this Labor Day. The U.S. stock markets will reopen tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.